the direction chosen by America in the months to come may well be the direction followed by the majority of the world's nations. American leadership is a vital factor in attainment of a lasting peace. From Rochester, New York, CBS brings you Sumner Wells, former Undersecretary of State, speaking in connection with the meeting of the Rochester Institute of International Affairs, which is sponsored by the American Association for the United Nations. Mr. Wells has chosen for his subject a decisive moment in American foreign policy. Mr. Wells.
It is a very high privilege to address the Institute of International Affairs of Rochester. This institute is justly entitled to the high reputation it has won. Its signal accomplishment is due in part to the sponsorship of such outstanding organizations as the American Association for the United Nations, the Foreign Policy Association, the City Club of Rochester, and the other distinguished groups which have joined in making possible the measure of its achievement. But there is also a growing public realization that its success is due primarily to the initiative and the vision of this great community of Rochester. And there is likewise a growing public realization of the national service the Institute is rendering by the enlightenment it is affording public opinion at this most critical moment in our national history. With the passing of the years, I am increasingly persuaded that our American democracy cannot succeed without an informed public opinion, and that unless the American people understand the issues arising in international relations and are given the chance to evaluate accurately the objectives sought and the methods employed by their government, American foreign policy cannot be that effective instrument of the popular will, which it must be if it is to succeed in times of international crisis like these. It is hardly necessary for me to add that I also regard it as a high honor to find myself associated with Dr. Robert Oppenheimer on this platform tonight. There are many far more qualified than I to speak of the immense contribution that he has made toward the development of a force which can become of infinite benefit to humanity, and to attest to the results achieved by Dr. Oppenheimer in his persistent endeavor to procure for us the assurance that this new force, whose discovery has brought mankind to the threshold of a new era, will be dedicated to the highest interests of mankind. Yet none of us can forget that the employment of the force engendered by atomic fission can destroy the remaining vestiges of a civilized world and bring to pass such annihilation and devastation as is yet barely imaginable. To those of us who lived our youth during the years before the First World War, the contrast between the world into which we were born and the kind of world in which we now exist seems at times so great as to make us wonder whether we have not unwittingly been translated to some other planet. The civilization which the 19th century developed had its profound social injustices and its patent structural weaknesses. And yet it was a civilization that had maintained peace. It was a civilization which had gradually evolved an enlightened concept of international law, in which comity and good faith in international relations were far more generally the rule than the exception. Above all else, perhaps, the young men and women who are coming to maturity after the turn of the century enjoyed an innate sense of security which our children and our grandchildren have never known. And that sense of security has not existed since those fatal days of August 1914. And from that time on, notwithstanding an occasional attempt at self-delusion in the decades between the two world wars, there has been a progressive deterioration in every standard of international conduct and a rapid disintegration of the fabric of what we have called Western civilization. There could be no more accurate description of the age in which we now live than that given by Osbert Sitwell. We have entered a world of wolf and buffalo politics, where to howl over your prey is to be realistic, where to bellow is to prove strength, and to whine is to show grace. The world in which we still, but only just, survive. The world in which the saber-toothed tiger and the ant are our paragons. But I've not come here tonight to deliver a Jeremiad. Nothing is more utterly futile than empty repining for better days. Nothing could be more wholly at variance with our traditional American manner of being than to dwell upon the obstacles and dangers which we as a nation face, and to fail to make a corresponding effort to find the way by which they can be surmounted. It is in no small part due to the unfaltering determination which the American people have shown from the time they won their independence, in the face of odds that have often seemed overwhelming, that the United States has today become the greatest power of the earth. It is solely because of my conviction that in the larger sphere in which they now play their part, the American people, by a realistic estimate of the obstacles they face, and by a demonstration of those same qualities which brought their country to its present stature, can ensure the survival of this nation and of its free institutions, and can help mankind to find the road that leads to peace, that I venture to speak to you tonight. At the close of the Second World War, the United States found itself in a position where its influence could prove decisive in determining the course of human destiny. That this country has not so far successfully availed itself of this opportunity is hardly open to question. Yet, diminishing though its scope may be, there is every reason to believe that the opportunity still exists. How long it will exist, who among us can predict? The question before us is whether we are going to seize the opportunity afforded before the time runs out. There is little danger that any appreciable sector of American public opinion will again hold that the United States can revert to its traditional isolation or shirk its world responsibilities. The danger lies rather in the failure of the American people to agree upon the way in which those world responsibilities should be carried out. The great decision the American people must make is whether the United States is to seek security by means of a purely national attempt to run the world alone single-handed, or whether the United States is to seek to obtain a peaceful world in which it can safely live through an international organization such as the United Nations, and thereby construct a lasting world order capable of ensuring human liberty, of promoting social progress, and of achieving collective security. During the 3.5 years that have passed since the Charter of the United Nations was signed at San Francisco, the national course we have pursued has unfortunately shown few signs that our government has itself as yet decided what the nature of that great decision should be. Our government has frequently reiterated its determination to strengthen the United Nations. It has often announced that the United Nations represents the foundation of American foreign policy. Yet that factor in our national policy has been far more often evidenced in words than in action. The truth is that there exists in Washington a powerful school of thought that maintains that two parallel policies should be carried on. The one, a policy of lip service to the United Nations. The other, a policy which seeks national strategic advantage. At this early stage of its existence, weakened by many unforeseen deficiencies, and deprived because of Russian opposition of that international police force by which its authority must be backed before it can function as envisaged in its charter, the United Nations is incapable of repressing the aggression of a major power. In view of these conditions, and in the light of unmistakable evidence, that the men presently in control of the Soviet dictatorship are bent upon a course of ruthless expansion. The peace of the world could not be maintained, and American foreign policy could exercise no real influence on world affairs unless the United States possessed all of the armed strength and all of the material resources needed to convince the Kremlin that further aggression would involve a grave risk. Yet many of us believe that the armed strength which the United States requires to preserve peace under these present abnormal conditions should and could be used to reinforce the United Nations rather than to further a policy which seeks to obtain exclusive national strategic advantages. We cannot afford to forget that when the executive first requested of the Congress the legislation required to give assistance to Greece and Turkey, the United Nations was wholly ignored, and that this cardinal defect was only remedied by the swift and effective intervention of Senator Vandenberg. We cannot afford to forget that although the United States was largely responsible for the adoption by the General Assembly of the United Nations of the resolution for the partition of Palestine on November 29, 1947, that measure represented the one important decision reached by the United Nations upon which the Soviet Union and the United States found themselves in agreement. The Soviet Union has ever since consistently maintained the position it originally assumed. Yet during the short space of these past 12 months, the United States has veered from one position to another. Within less than 2 months after the adoption of the resolution, this government prevented the Security Council from implementing its provisions. 6 weeks later, the United States was proposing the imposition of a trusteeship upon Israel and even threatening Israel's leaders with financial and commercial embargoes should their people, then struggling for their very lives, refuse to acquiesce. Shortly afterward, the president extended de facto recognition to Israel's provisional government. Again, a few weeks later, the American government gave official approval to the so-called Bernadotte proposal, which not only ignored the validity of the United Nations resolution, but would actually have nullified the resolution's fundamental objective. Again, after another few weeks, the United States was indicating its intention of joining in the imposition of sanctions upon the people of Israel because of their success in driving the invading armies of the Arab aggressors from the very territory granted to Israel by the Assembly's resolution. Now, the government of the United States has reverted to its original position. But can we maintain that the course pursued by our government has not gravely damaged the authority and prestige of the United Nations, or that it has not undermined the faith of other peoples in American dependability at a time when such faith is peculiarly necessary? Can we fail to see that our course has inevitably helped to convince the Soviet dictatorship that our asserted desire to strengthen the United Nations has counted for nothing in comparison with our search for military and strategic advantages in Palestine, and that it is military strategy and not support for the United Nations that has been responsible for our vacillating policy during the past year? At the present moment, negotiations are far advanced for the conclusion of a defensive alliance between the United States and other members of the so-called Atlantic Community. I believe in the need for this defensive measure because of my conviction that the conclusion of such a pact will render aggression against the Western nations more unlikely. But the project in its present form threatens to disregard even the terms of Senate Resolution 239, which calls for more effective use of the United Nations. And there is very real danger that the final pact will bypass Article 51 of the Charter, under which regional arrangements of this character may be established, and that by this decision, the United States will still further weaken the authority of the United Nations. Let me cite one final example of the manner in which we are failing in our acts to live up to our professions. In this last session of the General Assembly, the smaller countries, for the first time, assumed their rightful responsibilities. And because of their intense anxiety lest the Cold War be transformed into armed hostilities, sought tirelessly through their representatives on the Security Council to find some formula that would provide a peaceful settlement of the Berlin crisis. Some 2 weeks ago, the American delegation in Paris announced that the United States would cooperate wholeheartedly in the effort of the smaller countries. 1 hour later, the American military government in Berlin, through Colonel Howley, proclaimed that any such attempt was futile and would be doomed to failure. On November 30th, the President of the Security Council announced that the Western powers had approved in principle and that the Soviet government had accepted a formula by which a currency agreement for Berlin would be sought and by which the Soviet blockade would be lifted. Within 2 hours, the American military government in Berlin, through Colonel Howley, told the world that neither a currency agreement nor the lifting of the Soviet blockade would terminate the crisis, that the time had come for a showdown, and simultaneously announced a series of 5 sweeping demands upon the Soviet government, including so extreme a demand as a Soviet commitment to refrain in the future from all criticism of the United States and of its officials. Finally, 1 week ago today, when tension in Berlin had been measurably increased by the Russian installation in the city's eastern sector of a rump communist government, and when in Paris, the President of the Assembly, the Secretary General of the United Nations, and the members of the Security Council were endeavoring ably and devotedly to prevent the crisis from becoming still more acute, the American military government in Berlin, through Colonel Howley, encouraged the peacemakers in the United Nations by announcing to the world through the press that Russia now stands naked and alone as a government whose word cannot be trusted. Now, there are many other instances of this character which show why there is today so little confidence on the part of other peoples, and particularly on the part of the peoples of the smaller countries, that American policy is in fact dedicated to the achievement of world peace through the United Nations, or that it is not being dictated by our armed services. What is equally disastrous, at a time when the eyes of hundreds of millions of men and women who long for the assurance of future security are turning to the United States for a sign of that enlightened leadership which can satisfy their aspirations, American policy on many other vital questions seems to them so far to have failed to give the assurance they seek. In the European Recovery Program, the United States adopted a constructive policy destined not only to make possible the reconstruction of Western Europe, but destined as well to revitalize those forces that stand for human liberty. It is a positive policy. It is a policy for democracy, rather than a merely negative policy designed solely to check Soviet communism. But can we so appraise the policy our government has pursued in other cases? If the lessons to be learned from the years after the First World War taught us anything, they surely should have taught us that until the United Nations was able to repress aggression, the major powers should provide for the political decentralization of Germany and for a continuing international control over those industries and natural resources that represent Germany's war potential. What do we see today? we see a headlong rush on the part of the English-speaking powers toward the reconstitution in Western Germany of a highly centralized and autonomous German state, with the control over Germany's war potential being returned to the hands of those same German individuals whom the prosecuting authorities in the American occupation zone have proved to have collaborated with Hitler in his preparations for the Second World War. And we learn of a further provision that the future German state may itself acquire the control of that war potential. And this policy is being pursued, notwithstanding the protests of the French people through their National Assembly and of all of Germany's other smaller neighbors who rightly claim that this present policy of building up a highly industrialized and strong Western German state as a buffer against the Soviet Union totally ignores their legitimate demand for their future safety and disregards the tragic results of the very same policy when it was pursued in the 1920s. Can we point with satisfaction to the results of our policy in China during these past 3 years? Had we, after Japan's defeat, immediately attempted, as friendly mediators, to bring into existence in China a non-communist but truly liberal coalition government? And had we succeeded in that effort, and then devoted ourselves to making certain that the assistance we rendered China reached the masses of the Chinese people rather than a few thousand members of the official oligarchy, the nationalist government today might still possess that popular support on the part of the Chinese people without which it cannot succeed in its present contest. Of what benefit to ourselves, or for that matter to the Chinese people, as our policy of military intervention proved to be, can we assert that the methods to which we have resorted in China during these past 3 years have won for us the friendship of the Chinese people, contributed to the growth of freedom in China, or checked the rising tide of communism? The danger to our future interests that would result from a communist control of China is very great. But what can we hope to gain by trying through further military intervention to keep in power a government that the Chinese people themselves will not support? The record is very clear. That record shows that at this determining moment in world history, American policy is wavering between a course which would lead to international organization and collective security and to the revitalization of democracy, and a course which would lead inevitably to an American attempt to run the world by force single-handed. At this moment of all others, American policy cannot succeed unless it is consistent, unless it envisions the long-range as well as the short-range objectives, unless it selects the methods of implementation best calculated to serve those ends, and unless it convinces the other peoples of the world that American policy is dependable. The explanation for much of what has been taking place will be found in one passage of General Eisenhower's recent book. He tells us how in the summer of 1945, he urged the President and the then Secretary of State, Mr. Burns, to have the State Department take over from the Army the administration of our occupation zone of Germany, so that the armed forces would become the adjunct of the civil authority and no longer continue to be themselves the determining authority. And Secretary Burns refused to accept that responsibility. General Eisenhower, of course, was everlastingly right. He saw clearly where our true interests lay. And the professional military influence, which then first assumed predominance, has ever since been exercising an increasing measure of control over the determination of our foreign policy. Every major issue of foreign policy is now being decided by the National Security Council. And of the Council's 7 members, one has been a professional soldier throughout his long life of devoted and distinguished service to this country. And of the remaining members, all but one speak for and in the name of the armed services. The overshadowing issue is whether an American foreign policy which is formulated primarily from the military and strategic viewpoint, which regards force or the threat of force as its sole effective instruments, which envisages little more than the need to check Russia, can prevail in a contest with a force which is so eminently dynamic as the force of Soviet communism, backed as it is by the manpower and the resources of the vast Russian Empire. We have every reason to fear that even though actual war may be averted, the United States will be engaged in a losing fight unless American foreign policy becomes the instrument of a democracy which is quite as dynamic as communism, unless that policy offers the peoples of the earth the positive assurance that the United States seeks collective security rather than national aggrandizement, and unless it shows itself consistently bent upon the creation of that kind of a free, strong, and progressive world order foreseen in the Charter of the United Nations. By chance, these prophetic lines of Walt Whitman were given to me the other day. Years prophetical. The space ahead as I walk, as I vainly try to pierce it, is full of phantoms, unborn deeds, things soon to be, project their shapes around me. The performed America and Europe grow dim, retiring in shadow behind me. The unperformed, more gigantic than ever, advance, advance upon me. What will the unperformed prove to be? Will it be the Holocaust? And thereafter, the regimentation of the survivors of the human race in the fashion of the ants whom they will proclaim their paragon? Nor will it be Walt Whitman's vision. I see freedom, with law on the one side and peace on the other. The American people have the capacity, the power, and the opportunity to determine what that future will hold.
Thank you, Mr. Wells. From Rochester, New York, you have heard Sumner Wells, former Undersecretary of State. Mr. Wells spoke in connection with the meeting of the Rochester Institute of International Affairs, which is under the sponsorship of the American Association for the United Nations. Immediately preceding this musical interlude, from Rochester, New York, you had heard Sumner Wells, former Undersecretary of State. Mr. Wells spoke in connection with a meeting of the Rochester Institute of International Affairs, which is under the sponsorship of the American Association for the United Nations. This broadcast came to you in line with CBS policy of keeping you informed on all matters of public interest. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.